My name is Noah Salsick, and I am a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by Dr. Michael Kototwa-Johnson, a faculty member and assistant specialist with the Indigenous Resiliency Center at the University of Arizona's School of Natural Resources and the Environment. A member of the Hopi tribe, he practices traditional Hopi dry farming, a foundation of his work on Indigenous food systems. Today, April 7th, Dr. Johnson is here visiting Dickinson College to give a lecture titled Revitalization of the American Indian Food System. In this interview, we'll dive further into Dr. Johnson's work, which has explored the impact of federal policies on Indigenous food systems, the health consequences of losing access to traditional foods, and the path forward for revitalizing Indigenous farming practices. Welcome, Dr. Michael Kototwa-Johnson. Thank you again for being here. I want to start by asking about your journey as a farmer and as a researcher. Do you feel like the bio I just gave is accurate? Who really is Dr. Kototwa-Johnson? What would you want myself and whoever's listening to know about you?
Well, I think, you know, the bio that you gave is fine. You know, I always consider myself a 250th generation Hopi farmer more than anything else before my academic work or my jobs that I've had or my journeys that I've had. I think, you know, being brought up to farm and learning how to farm at a very, very young age, starting around 10, I really have appreciated not only the physical environment of farming, but also the values that I've learned from my grandfather. It was my grandfather when I was a young man who brought me out there. After my dad would drop me off, he was in the military, so I'd spend my summers up there, and that's where I really got to appreciate how to farm. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Absolutely. Connecting to that, I've been reading your article in Reasons to Be Cheerful about your farming, and you said that one reason you pursued a PhD was to ensure mainstream stakeholders would listen to you. What else inspired that decision? And looking back, how have you seen the landscape of Indigenous research, resilience, and stewardship evolve? How has the power dynamic shifted over time?
Well, I think one of the biggest things that we see now is just this whole thing called IndigiSov or IndigiGovernance, where we're able to actually make sure that the stuff that's done on Indian lands and probably throughout the globe with Indigenous people is that we get to be the owners of the data. Along with the owners of the data, it also brings us recognition. That's one thing that I'm constantly striving for, is to move the idea of the American Indian being with feathers and certain regalia to be moved off the black and white pictures off the museum walls and into mainstream contemporary society. I think, you know, we've been here for a long time. We've cultivated this land. We've lived on this land. We call the United States, and we need to be recognized for the contributions that we're continuing to make and the ones that we have made. And that's now we're able to write the narrative finally and not be part of the history. We're able to write the narrative, and I think that's very important moving forward.
As do I. That connects perfectly to the next question I had, which was talking about a rise in interest in regenerative agriculture in recent years. But many Indigenous farmers I've read about have pointed out that these quote-unquote new techniques are actually based on practices from Indigenous people that have been used for centuries. Do you think the regenerative agriculture movement is doing enough to recognize this and learn from Indigenous farmers? And how do you see Indigenous knowledge systems integrating into conventional conservation?
Well, I think regenerative agriculture is a good movement. Let's put it that way, because it does renew a lot with soil health, and that's very important for what the plant uptakes to getting onto your living room or your dining room table. But I think to make it truly regenerative, it needs to have its own definition. And I've done that in one of my works, where part of that is, you know, not only soil health, but also the regeneration of our cultural and identity and our belief systems, and tie it to that, because that's so much of what makes it sustainable. Regenerative agriculture is still, in my mind, still too tied up in the processes. And so, and what I mean by processes, I mean by practices and how it's applied, you know, what it's supposed to do. But with our system of traditional regenerative agriculture, Indigenous regenerative agriculture, we have that, like I said, that whole cultural belief system that's tied to identity and the relationship we have with the environment, see? And so it's more important for me to teach my youth at home why they're farming rather than just the processes, because the processes over time have changed. I mean, if you look at regenerative agriculture, organic farming, you know, all these things that are out there, buzz terms I would call them, it really comes back to the relationship we have with the land.
I think that's really well put. I wanted to say, connecting to that, you've talked a little bit in some of the articles you've been quoted in or authored that not as many people as maybe you would like on your reservation as part of your tribe are able to farm, because you don't own the land. Some have argued that reservations and national parks should be returned to indigenous stewardship. What impact do you think this could have on land conservation and indigenous sovereignty? And is there another option that you would like to propose?
No, I think the return the land back stuff I think is valid. But when the land comes back, it's just that's we also have to have the resources that come back too, because a lot of this stuff is very financially taxing on tribes with little or no income, and so we got to look at that big picture. As far as the management, the ideas, the co-management agreements that I see, I think are excellent. Like the ones they have at Bears Ears, where we're bringing in the tribes that have had something to do with that to bring them back to help give advice to things like that, I think are very important moving forward. Right now, my own main concern is that we have the potential to take some of this land and privatize it, which would be no access for anybody. So we have to worry about that. But for the most part, I think, just letting the Indians manage it and just helping them give advice like forest management, especially in that area where we see massive wildfires in California, where no management has been done and forest policy, national policy hasn't really allowed that in. It's going to start to have to allow that in. And there are tribes that are working with the forest, because we cannot have these billion-dollar losses that impact not only environment, but people's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's good to talk about Bears Ears now. It's even more relevant now. Shifting gears a little bit, the scientific journal Nature recently published a paper saying that the well-known claim that 80% of the world's biodiversity is in territory stewarded by indigenous communities, they said that's not accurate. And they actually went on to say that such a claim may take away from the cause it's trying to promote. You made a post on Instagram pushing back on this and saying that this article takes away from the role of indigenous communities. Would you talk a little bit more about this?
Well, I think, that was an article, and then me and a colleague of mine, Kyle White, who's also a well-known author on these issues, we have to push back, because it may not be 80%, and those people who wrote that article did not mention how that biodiversity was going to be documented. Biodiversity is very hard to document it, but we know for a fact that there are higher rates of biodiversity that are managed by American Indians or indigenous people than out there in the rest of the world. And also along with that high rates of biodiversity are high rates of language richness. And so that's important too. So my fallback and pushback to that is like, so what? So what if it's not 80%? The authors of that article did not mention how we're supposed to do that. We just know that it's high there, right? And for them to put a claim like that, to me, takes away from all the work and all the recognition that we are as native stewards of the land. And so that's how we're going to push back. We're going to write a letter to the authors and make sure that they rethink about some of their stuff, and so that's just how it is. It's everything we do sometimes is controversial because it's different, and so we have to kind of deal with the differences as we can. So,
and I'm glad you said that. It kind of goes back to what you're saying about pushing back on just the processes. It's about much more than that. What do you hope non-native, non-farmer audience members will take away from your lecture tonight?
I think the main thing that I want to take away is that we can work together. Changing the climate, if that's what they want to call it, or environmental fluctuations, I guess is a new term now, to show that we can work together as a people, because we all live here on this planet. And I think if anything, it would be that we can all work together, that we collaborate, and that there is a different way of looking at things. And I think as long as we have this understanding with each other, we have this communication going on, I think we can just help each other in many ways that we didn't think were possible before.
Well said. Okay, that brings us to the end of our time together. Lastly, is there anything else that you didn't get to talk about, or that I didn't bring up, or you saw I said wrong, you want to mention?
Well, I think the interview was good, and I just don't think there's really anything at this point that I would like to bring up, except the fact that, I always like to bring up the fact that, in Vine Deloria Jr.'s work, In Custer Died for Your Sins, which was published in about the 60s during the time of the Civil Rights Movement, and things that were going on here in this country. And one of the things that I'm still striving for, and I think people need to understand this, is that, we as indigenous people are not really looking for equality, but we're looking still for recognition.
Yeah.
And so until we get that recognition, we will never be thought of as anything else but indigenous people. And so I really want to bring that apart, that recognition comes first before you can even have equality. And I hope that we can do that, and I hope that my presence here allows for recognition to continue.
I hope so too. Thank you everyone so much for listening. This brings us to the end of this quick interview with Dr. Johnson. If you didn't get the chance to attend the lecture in person, you can watch the recording on clarkforum.org. It should be listed under past programs, and you can find it April 7th. And there's a few links you can check out Dr. Johnson's work and research. He also posts quite frequently on his Instagram. It's Dr. Hopi Farmer. Thank you so much for listening, and all right, bye.